called The Black Man Is God.
Yeah, the God.
It's called The Black Man Is God.
Gotta next make sure album. The
this is for the children. You know what I'm saying? I got
you
this
me?
Idea from myself, of course, but this is for the children. I got.
Make this prediction. This will be the biggest upset in all this fighting history. Be the easiest fight of my life.
You think your cousin can whoop me?
You really do?
Anybody on your watch?
Anybody in my family?
He's young. He's handsome.
They know it.
He's a poet, a prophet.
The goal ain't having that. Who would have dreamed from karaoke to cassette? I met OB as an OG in the taxi. Nah, I was legends. Rest in peace, Pop's a legend. Mike Corey and Sean Jordan was the essence of the young chorus where we grew from. Seemed like a second, now they less important to the new sun. I guess today weighs more than yesterday. It's morbid to suggest that they will come for them too. When it's a brother younger than you, who humble and who? Used to coach him, night coast and blew up. Who knew? He caught you on a rough night, you were stumbling through. Now he telling you to get yours, get yours.
All of you reporters made it hard on them. Never write about me like him. Yours, never make me yours. Think wrong. Just make me angry. Never make me go underdog. And never yours, talk about yours. Who's gonna stop me. Well, ain't nobody gonna stop me. Not a heavyweight in the world fast enough to stop me.
They didn't give us a chance. They didn't give us a chance. But here we are, man. And when I say we, of course, I'm talking about the Cleveland Cavaliers, your 2015-2016 National Basketball Association champions. Words that I never thought that I'd be saying, but here we are, and I'm saying them because it happened. It happened. Cleveland, Ohio. You have a champion, and it's the Cleveland Cavaliers. This is the preseason podcast of the year. I am Jay Hicks on the mic again. Good to hear from you guys, you know. It's been not that long this time around. I think we had gone several weeks between the last time we had a podcast and the time before that, and now this time we're only about a week apart, but things have been happening. Things are happening. Things are changing, and here we are. We have a new champion crowned. And it's the first time the city of Cleveland has hoisted a trophy that was not minor league hockey or minor league soccer in 52 years. So it's a pretty remarkable experience. My hometown is going berserk, and people are jumping on top of buses, and you can't even hop on the Rita no more because people are dancing on top of buses. They're in the streets. They hijacking fire trucks, allegedly. I'm hearing about everything that's going down in the city of Cleveland. Unfortunately, I can't be there right now, but that is what's happening, man. And the prodigal son, LeBron James, has delivered and fulfilled the promise that he said he was going to by bringing Cleveland a championship. It's crazy. Today's podcast, we're going to be talking about the finals, obviously, and we're going to do a little mock draft with our favorite guest, Mark Hicks, our draft analyst. So he's back once again to talk NBA draft. Mark, you're on the line right now on the Your Ad Here hotline. And I feel like any Clevelander that's been a true Cleveland fan from the beginning, from jump, especially if you were born in the city, or if your father was born in the city or something like that, you're a champion today. You are a champion, just like the players are champions. You didn't play in the games, but damn it, you was there and you was sweating it out last night, and you cried every tear, and you were with the teams, all the Cleveland teams, as they went through each traumatic experience, and, you know, here we are. So, Mark, how you feel today? How does it feel to be a champion today?
Man, first of all, happy Championship Monday to you, cousin. And for all of those who have suffered through Red Right 88, the drive, the fumble, the shot, Jose Mesa giving it up in the ninth inning, all these different things, man. And just to me, I was saying this last night, I'm still numb today. It's like it's almost unreal, because I saw it with my own eyes, never thought I would see it for my lifetime, and yet I still have a hard time just grasping the fact that these dudes went out there and did the impossible. Because I'll be honest with you, after they lost game four, it had nothing to do with talent. Because I still thought this team was talented enough to come back from 3-1. I just didn't know if they had the mental makeup and or the fact that I didn't give a lot of confidence in Ty Lue to devise a game plan to get them back or keep them even keeled to even make a comeback. So, man, I'm on cloud nine, but I honestly still feel numb to this day. As of right now, I'm still numb. I can't believe they actually did it.
Well, I'm glad you brought up some of the things that you brought up, and so if you listen to our last show, and of course if you haven't, you can always go back and listen to our last podcast. The Hip Hop Sports Report podcast is on Stitcher Radio and on iTunes. We're working on getting up on Google Play, and that actually may be approved as soon as today. So we could be on Google Play very shortly as well. So
nice.
Yeah, so that's happening, and we're everywhere. We're even on SoundCloud, sort of. I don't really like to advertise that, but I'm just throwing it out there right now
because I'm in a good mood. The Cavs won the championship. I'm in a good mood, so.
Yeah, it's on SoundCloud a little, you know, sort of, but that's a whole nother situation. So if you listen to last week's show, I talked about first of all, so this is, I've done this before, I think, on the podcast, but let's listen up. Hear that? That's the sound of me patting myself on the back right there.
All right,
because. Unlike the national media pundits out there, and unlike all the talking head jokers out there, I, your boy, not only did I have the Cavaliers winning the NBA championship before the season started, not only did I have the Cavaliers facing the Golden State Warriors in the NBA Finals at the start of the playoffs, but I also had the Cavaliers winning the NBA championship at the start of the series, defeating the Warriors. And when the Cavaliers were down 3-1 on last week's show, I said the Cavs aren't dead yet. And I made that very clear. I said I am not jumping ship on the Cavs just yet. I believe that the Warriors were a beatable team. I said it in the conference final piece that I had written, that I thought that Golden State was a beatable team. I had them beating Oklahoma City in 7, but I said that the aura of invincibility was gone for the Warriors. I said that in the NBA Finals preview, I said that the maturity factor or lack thereof could be an issue. I said that the Cavs looked like the more mature team, and that would factor in. And boy, did it ever. You have, you know, Maurice Space running off his on the mouth on Twitter and writing articles for the Player Tribune talking about Steph's about to drop 50 in Game 7, all this kind of craziness. You got Klay Thompson calling out LeBron in the media. You have Ayesha Curry doing her thing, and not that she's directly impacts the team, but, I mean, it created a lot of headlines and stuff that Golden State didn't need when they were in the fight of their life. You have Draymond Green getting baited by LeBron in Game 4, and the series clearly turned on that altercation between Draymond and LeBron. From that moment, like, the Cavs really kind of clicked in gear. Now, granted, they had won the game before. They had won Game 3, and they had the lead for much of Game 4, but it wasn't until that moment that the tide really seemed to shift. Draymond got suspended, which I said he should have been suspended, because not only was that, even though that act was not, there was not much to that act, the fact that he had a history and that there was a pattern of behavior meant that he deserved to get suspended. And I don't know how you can ignore that just because of the NBA Finals. So you had Draymond, you know, people getting in his head. And Steve Kerr was kind of arrogant through the media as well. I mean, there was just a lot of signs that this team was not nearly as mature as people thought. And we saw it again as soon as they faced a little adversity. Now you got Steph chucking mouthpieces and getting kicked out of games, even though he's at fault for reaching in like a dummy most of the time. So there, stuff like that, you know, I had that. It was in the column that I had written. This is turning into the segment, the Justin was right segment. So just bear with me here, Mark. And I mean, because this is the thing. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be that guy. But what I want to do and what I'm always trying to do here is establish credibility for this website and for this podcast. We know what we're doing over here. Y'all need to catch up. Okay, because the whole world said that the Golden State Warriors was going to roll on the Cavs, especially when it was 3-1. You know, and I didn't say that. I said the Cavs had more motivation. Not that, I mean, everybody wants to be a champion, but it means a little something extra to the team that's usually more mature. They're at a time or a point in their career where everything kind of comes together perfectly. That's what we saw from LeBron James. We looked at the age of the two teams. The Cavaliers are right on par with where you want to be as far as the average age of a typical champion in recent years. You had the entire Golden State team, everything that they were doing as far as their approach to the game seemed a little bit off since the Oklahoma City series. I don't want to go as far as to say they got exposed, but the aura of invincibility was gone. Meanwhile, you had LeBron, who was playing with more motivation than ever before, and he found himself in a one-game situation where he could exercise all the demons at once, and he wasn't going to let that chance slip through his hands. I referenced the fact that Golden State, even though they played in the West, people just assumed that they've had adversity. No, they hadn't, okay? Because even though Steph got hurt, the Clippers got hurt at the same time Steph got hurt, so they avoided the Clippers in the second round. That would have been a second round and out for the Warriors had the Clippers been healthy, but the Clippers got hurt. So the Warriors caught another break. In two seasons and two full runs to the championship, Golden State got to the finals twice, and they only had two legitimate opponents in those eight playoff series that they played: Oklahoma City and this year against the Cavs. And so the Cavs actually had way more adversity, as I talked about in the piece before the finals started, and it showed up, because once a little adversity hit, Golden State ain't had nothing for it. I said LeBron had finals experience in Game 7. Golden State's big guns did not. That's a different kind of pressure that LeBron was used to that the rest of those guys weren't. And we saw it manifest itself. So, yeah, kudos to myself for getting all that right. And even in the past, I've talked about how you want to make sure you do your best to limit Klay and Steph, and that you want to make Draymond a scorer. If you make Draymond a scorer, it's a problem for the Warriors. Draymond went nuts yesterday. But what happened? Golden State only finished the game with 89 points. That's a recipe for disaster if Draymond is your leading scorer. That's not how they want to play. So, I mean, there was a lot of things, and I know I'm going to forget stuff, and I'm going to be kicking myself after we take this podcast because I forgot to mention that, and you know, that's going to happen. I already know that, but I just had to get that out there, man, because I'm trying to build this thing up, man, and y'all got to listen to your boy, man. But Mark, what surprised you most about the finals and how they played out? So I understand you're still in shock and you're still numb, and I am too, to a large degree. In fact, I was, when the Cavs actually won, as a fan, as a Clevelander, when the Cavs won at the end, I found myself jumping and screaming in my home, running around like a crazy person, and possibly frightening my son, who's 6 months old. And I got down on my knees and started making some type of high-pitched noise that most grown men don't typically make. It was a very strange situation. It was almost an out-of-body experience that I kind of went through. It was almost like, you know, I mean, I won't go as far as say I was speaking in tongues or anything, but it was just a really weird, you know what I'm saying? Just a really weird, like, I was just like, there was no words, just high-pitched noises were coming out of my mouth, and then I just had to grab my son and hold him close to me because I felt like he's the one that actually brought the championship, because I've been waiting for all my life for a championship, and he's only been waiting for 6 months, and here we are. But what was it like for you, Mark? What surprised you most about how the finals played out on the court, and what's the city like right now?
To answer your last question first, I mean, I still, even, you know, 3 o'clock this afternoon, I still had cars driving by my house still honking their horns and still people yelling out, "Go Cavs!" And it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon and I live in the suburbs outside of Cleveland. So it's like, it's mayhem out there, man. It's still, they had the team come in, at the IX Center, and they had a big, I guess, a rally there, and there was like thousands of people there. That place was immensely packed, and it was just, it's been absolutely nuts for the last, 17 to 18 hours. It's been absolutely crazy. But I will say this, I was fortunate here to watch Game 7 with my family. My brother and his family was here, and my mother was here. And I think just from to experience this moment with them, you know, as 44-year-old man who's never, you know, who's went through all the different Cleveland sports tragedies I just mentioned, I was alive for all of them. I saw all of them live. And to me, just for that to come full circle like that, man, it was awesome. And then, you know, just to have, you know, my family here, I think the only thing that I really truly miss was my pops not being here, you know. And he's been gone from this earth for almost six years now. And, you know, he was the person who instilled all of this pride in me about Cleveland, about taking care of the teams that, you know, that support your home and everything like that. And I think just not having the ability to share that with him at that moment was probably the only, I guess, downside to this. But it was, the whole atmosphere was awesome. And it was, and you talk about that shriek that you yelled out. I had a similar shriek myself. And the house was just, you know, we had cops on our street just basically just, you know, holding it down because they already knew what was going to happen. And I think they were out there trying to celebrate a little bit too, by the way. But it was an awesome experience. And I think, you know, looking back on this, you know, a few years down the road, that's going to be cool. And just something to really see and think about, you know, because now I was able to share this with my family. And I think that was the coolest part of this. As far as what surprised me the most, two things surprised me, and I don't think there's one thing. One was the fact that, you know, just the mental attitude of the Cavaliers to come back. I will say this, that I think Golden State had a little bit of a hand in that, in their comeback. Not necessarily what, you know, people might think, you know, well, Draymond Green got suspended and Bogut got hurt. None of that stuff. It was the fact that they were running their mouths. All year long, this team has been showing that they've been extremely arrogant and increasingly immature. They've been showing that all season long, just from the standpoint that they came back because they kept hearing people say, well, if the Cavs were fully healthy, they would have beat you guys. So they came with an agenda. They wanted to come out here, break the regular season record, cap it off with a title, and cement their place in history to show that last year wasn't a fluke. And it was to the point that even when they played the Cavs, they got up for the Cavs games more than the Cavs got up for them because they wanted to stick it to them and get in their heads and think that they were, you know, better than them. I never for once thought that they were better than them, but I just thought the Cavs allowed them to succumb to the fact that, you know, that they were beating them in the middle game. And I thought that was the crucial thing. But I think what changed the whole series was not necessarily the play with Draymond Green, you know, did what he did with LeBron, and they got into it, and he got, you know, and he got suspended for it. But the words after, the words from Klay Thompson basically saying that, you know, I guess LeBron's feelings got hurt. The fact that there was actually not just the players, but the coaching staff and fans there in Oakland basically saying that their championship was against Oklahoma City, that they didn't feel that the Cavs were a threat. And I think all of that, and it, especially after they were up 3-1 and they started hearing it more and more, I think that really pissed LeBron off in particular, who then, and then I guess you'll hear about this later on, but Phil Handy, one of the Cavs assistant coaches, went off on the team after game four. And or actually game two, and told them, like, look, you guys aren't playing like you're playing like you're scared of them. And this guy grew up in the Bay Area, you know what I'm saying? So he took that to heart, and I think it flipped the switch more for guys like Kyrie, who's never been there before. And you can see, and the blueprint was already been out with Steph Curry. Steph Curry is an amazing shooter, probably the best shooter that's ever walked the face of this earth. But the biggest problem was, and this is why I don't feel that his game translates throughout generations, because of the fact that if he was playing in the 80s and 90s, he would be physically beaten up. The guy is only like 180, 90 pounds soaking wet anyway. And his physical frame cannot – do you understand, like, the teams like the Knicks and the Bulls and all these teams of the 80s and 90s, do you know what they would physically do to this kid? If he, after he hit like two or three threes, they would bombard him with screens. And that's exactly what Oklahoma City did and the Cavs did. They kept switching, kept getting bodies on him, kept getting in his face. And then the most important thing of all, and this is what I was talking about to you last year, was that on the flip side, Steph Curry had to guard somebody who was a scorer. Yes. With both the Cavs. When Roberson started, when Roberson and Deion Waiters started scoring for the Thunder, there was no place for Steph Curry to hide. It's the exact same thing with the Cavaliers. Once your backcourt, once you have a backcourt that actually scores points, you as a defender, as Steph Curry, you can't, there's no place you can hide. They always put Steph Curry on the weakest score because that way he can relax on defense. He doesn't have to worry about them scoring. And then they run a freelance offense anyway. They really don't run much of a structured offense unless it's a timeout situation. So he's out there running around doing whatever he wants to do on offense. But because he has to guard people and he has to run through screens, he has to do all this stuff, that takes a toll of him in a 7-game series. That's the difference. The difference between Oklahoma City and the Cavs was that the Cavs were more mature because they were more veteran club, whereas Oklahoma City was not. And I think that immaturity cost them in the end because they had everything that they needed to beat Golden State and they just didn't take advantage of it. However, the Cavs took care of every single advantage after game four. And they took it to them. And, as a fan of the team, but most importantly, as a fan of basketball, that was amazing to watch. And they deserve everything. And I think they were the biggest thing going back and forth was, well, did the Cavs win the series or did Golden State lose the series? Cavaliers to them. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. Yes, the Warriors did. Like I said, the only thing they did was by running their mouths. And then you get Ayesha Curry running her mouth on Twitter, talking about the league was rigged, all this stuff. Don't think that stuff didn't affect them. The pressure of having 73 wins, don't think that didn't affect them. So now where do you place them in history? They have the best regular season, but they don't win the title. So what was it all for? I can guarantee you this. After this season, no other team is going to try to go for a record. That 73-9 is going to stay there because nobody's going to take the regular season that seriously to the point where they feel that they have to go 74-8 and then win the title. Nobody's going to do that. The pressure will be too immense. It's just about playing your best basketball at the right time, and that's what the Cavs did, and that's what a lot of teams going to do going forward.
I would agree with that. You said a lot there, Mark. So I'm going to touch on a few things you said. First of all, I'm going to start off with Kyrie. So Kyrie was phenomenal, and obviously the focus today is on LeBron, rightfully so. LeBron won MVP, deservedly so, unanimously, which is funny now they're throwing out the unanimous term for finals MVP. I never heard the term unanimous associated with finals MVP until this year with all the unanimous talk, which is funny.
Right. One question, though. Do you feel that he was the MVP?
LeBron?
I mean, LeBron. I'm just saying that because I can see why. But in that case, do you think that LeBron deserved MVP, or do you think that Kyrie deserved MVP? Because that's another topic that's going on around here.
Yeah, I think LeBron James absolutely deserved MVP. When you lead both teams in points, rebounds, assists, steals, and blocks for an entire 7-game series against what was supposed to be the greatest team of all time, and you lead both teams in all those statistics, I don't see how it can be anybody else. Now, Kyrie was fantastic. Kyrie was dynamic. From game three on, he looked like a different player. He got his head in the game. He was ultra aggressive. And one thing that the Cavaliers aren't getting enough credit for, and you touched on it, Mark, they sought out Stephen Curry on defense. Not only did they score and just say, you know, Kyrie, go get yours, and that'll offset Curry, which was another thing that I was right about from last year, was that the reason why I picked the Cavs to beat Golden State last year, and the reason why I did that was because, or a large reason as to why I did that was because I felt that Kyrie could play Curry to a draw, and then the Cavs still had LeBron James. So,
right.
But nobody really looked at it that way back then. And then Kyrie got hurt, so it was a moot point and it went out the window. But this year, here we are. Kyrie actually outplayed Curry thoroughly.
Yep.
And we still had LeBron James. And so, it took a lot, but, you know, and it still took, even with that, it still took to the final minute of the final game, but that was the difference with the game. And so Kyrie was tremendous. He hit the big shot, obviously. That's going to be one of the greatest shots in the history of basketball. And Kyrie was tremendous, but he was following LeBron's lead. I think Kyrie would be the first to admit it. He was following LeBron's lead, and this was LeBron's moment. The defensive plays that LeBron was making all series long were awesome, awesome stuff. As soon as on the last podcast, I called him out. I said, I haven't seen any chase down blocks. Haven't seen any of this. And then what does he start doing? He starts flying up and down the court, blocking everything in sight. LeBron was tremendous. And I wrote a piece today. It's up today on hiphopsportsreport.com about LeBron and basically just talking about his place now next to Jordan and Kobe in history, because the stands, the Jordan stands and the Kobe stands get on my nerves more than anybody, because they act like those two guys cannot be touched ever, ever. Yeah. And it's so maddening, because Kobe is largely, I mean, as great of a player as Kobe was, and he was, I think he's top 10 all time, but in a lot of respects, Kobe kind of lives off this reputation that he never really completely earned. I really believe that.
And that's a whole other story. I agree with you on that.
And that's another story for another day on another podcast, but that exists. And then Jordan, even though Jordan might be at the top of the mountain, that doesn't mean he's untouchable. And you have somebody doing what LeBron is doing. I mean, it's not out of pocket to put him and Jordan in the same sentence anymore. I mean, it's just not. And I didn't think it was before, as far as from a game-by-game standpoint. I mean, I watched Jordan in his prime. LeBron can affect the game just as much as Jordan can, if not more so. So it wasn't,
no question.
Yeah, so, I mean, that was always that was never a problem for me, but now he's got the resume to back it up, and he did some stuff that Mike never did. So go ahead and read that article, and I don't want to step on that too much, but I am going to step on another article, another comment I want to write real quick before we get into the draft. So Golden State, man, like pretty much all of their chickens came home to roost at the same time. And it was fascinating to watch, but the sheer arrogance that they operated with was stunning, and nobody really called them on it. Like, everybody likes the Warriors and they love the way they play and everything, but they were really feeling themselves, and everything, all the benefits, all the breaks, everything that was going their way the last two seasons all came to a head. They were a picture of health forever. For two straight years, they didn't have one significant injury. Now they're starting to get a little banged up in the playoffs. Next thing you know, they're getting banged up in the finals. Stuff was going their way as far as calls and things like that, just during games. And you saw Draymond acting out, and he's kicking people and punching people in the junk and not getting penalized for it, really. Like, still not getting kicked out of games or getting suspended. That came to a head. And Steph Curry just running around the floor, like you said, without anybody laying a hand on him, that finally stopped. The overconfident players and the stuff that they were saying in the media, their fans, the bandwagon, the Golden State fans, extremely arrogant, extremely cocky.
Extremely arrogant.
Right. They all said, y'all said it was going to be different when you had Love and Kyrie. This is when they were up 3-1. It's like, oh, y'all said it was going to be different because y'all got Love and Kyrie. What's your excuse now? What's your excuse now? You know how many times I saw "what's your excuse now" on social media? Way too many times coming from their fan base. And their owner. How about their owner, Joe Lacob, going into the news talking about how they were revolutionizing the game of basketball? And they were light. I think the quote was, they were light years ahead of every other team in the league. That was like a month before the playoffs.
Yep.
You know, I mean, everything. You know, Klay Thompson saying that they're better than the Lakers. Draymond, I think, might have said that they were better than the Bulls or gunning for the Bulls record. Like, some of that stuff was tongue-in-cheek, but everything that they were doing just signified that their head was not in the right place as far as them winning a championship. They just assumed that they were going to win. And when things didn't go their way, you saw Steph throwing his pacifier into the crowd, and you saw his wife complaining about... Right, and you saw his wife complaining about the league being rigged. You know, that's classic baby stuff. And they want to call LeBron a baby. It's like, y'all some suckers for that. But all of the chickens came home to roost at one time, and they did not have the spine to withstand it, or the health for that matter, because Bogut, his injury mattered a little bit. You know, who's going to set those moving screens? He's not in there, you know?
So, righty.
So, yeah, all that stuff mattered. I was happy to see Kevin Love had a pretty good game seven. I reiterate what I said on the last podcast. There is no way that they should trade Kevin Love, because I've hearing people on TV today saying that the Kevin Love thing still didn't work. It's like, they just won a championship. I don't see.
Right. How does it not work? That drives me crazy.
I don't know either. So, all of that is It's just a really fascinating series how the whole thing unfolded, but it really was LeBron's moment, and like I said, LeBron 100% deserved MVP. Kyrie was the epitome of a clutch wingman, the type of guy that you can count on when the chips are down, and so LeBron doesn't have to do every last thing. I thought Tristan was great the last two games of the series. I ride Tristan, Mark. I get on him from time to time. He was fantastic in game six, and he was solid in game seven. He was very good anytime he was asked to switch out on Curry. And Kevin Love on that last possession where he switched out on Steph Curry, that was the best
outstanding defense
Kevin Love ever played. It was fantastic. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, it was a great, great series, a great game. It was, you know, one of the best we've ever seen. I can't wait to go back and rewatch it on DVR from start to finish later tonight. I don't know if I'm going to be able to make the parade, but I can't wait for it regardless. So shout out to the Cleveland Cavaliers, all the fantastic people that work for the team, and all of the players, obviously, who went out and got the job done, man. From the bottom of the hearts of every Clevelander everywhere, thank you. Mark, let's talk a little draft, man. This is your thing, man, the mock draft. So, you know, everybody, I think by now, the world knows what the mock draft is all about. You know, you're going to tell us what each team in the lottery should do with their pick. And we only got about a half an hour to work with, if that. So we're going to have to hustle up and get through these picks fairly quickly. But there still is a lot to discuss. The Philadelphia 76ers, who you and I have talked a lot about on the podcast the last few years, because they're always drafted at the top of the draft somewhere. You know, they're always near the top of the draft in some capacity. They have the number one pick finally, but Sam Hinkie's gone, so sucks to be him. They have the top pick. There's rumors that they're going to try to make a deal they're going to try to move one of their other big men, because Ben Simmons is actually not a small dude. If he is the top pick, he's pretty tall, so they don't want to have four guys that are 6'10 and above in their lineup. Nerlens Noel, Joel Embiid, who's never played a game, Jahlil Okafor. It's a really weird hodgepodge of big men. There's rumors that they're going to deal at least one of them, maybe two of them, and then maybe draft Simmons. If you're on the clock, Mark, what are you doing with that pick? What do you think Philly should do?
Well, the consensus number one pick is Ben Simmons from LSU. Like you said, his skill set will remind people of LeBron James, because he has the ability to affect different areas on the floor, and he's a stat stuffer. Two problems with him that I think that makes it wrong with the Sixers is the fact that he can't shoot. He's not good of an outside shooter, and for the most part, even though he's gifted, he's a physically gifted athlete, his basketball IQ leaves something to be desired as well. So, and I look at it, if you put Ben Simmons on
sounds
the
like
Sixers,
sound like you described Stephen Curry with that last comment.
I mean, seriously though, because I'm looking at it like this, I'm like, if you put Ben Simmons on the Sixers, where are the outside scoring going to come from? Who's shooting on that team? And that goes back to Sam Hinkie and his sandbagging that you've been talking about for years, not drafting guys who could have helped this team early on from an outside scoring standpoint. Ben Simmons may be the best all-around talent, but he doesn't fit what the Sixers are going. So for me in this draft, I'm going to take the other guy. I'm taking Brandon Ingram at number one.
Wow.
And the main reason why, just two things. Number one, Brandon Ingram is 14 months younger than Ben Simmons, number one. And he's already a much better shooter than Simmons ever is. And then on top of that, yes, he has to get bigger physically, but the fact that he can spread the floor with his outside shooting, that leaves room for Okafor if he's still there, Embiid, Nerlens Noel. It gets those people out, you know, lets them run around free inside the paint. Because if you get another guy who can't shoot and has to be inside the 3-point line, that whole area is going to be cluttered up. Brandon Ingram can provide some type of outside scoring and spread the floor open for anybody who's playing point guard or the bigs inside that need to go inside and power inside. It doesn't clog up the lane. And like I said, he has a lot of raw talent and that you just can't teach. His shooting is unbelievable for a guy of his size. So if all he needs to do is just add bulk. He's in the, you know, the Nerlens Noel, you know, weight training program. He's that slim of a guy. But I think if he puts on weight, he is a difference maker that Philadelphia needs more so than just, you know, a guy who's ultra talented like Ben Simmons. So Brandon Ingram's the guy for me at number one with Philly.
So I got a few things to say about that. So number one, I'm kind of with you on Ben Simmons from the standpoint that I'm not sold on that guy at all. Like, the fact that, granted, he may have walked into a bad situation with a bad coach and bad teammates at LSU. He had a connection to LSU, like a personal one. But his decision to go there was a terrible one, frankly.
Without question.
But at the same time, if he's as good as everybody says he is, because he's the next LeBron. Everybody's the next LeBron now. They've been trying to find the next LeBron for 10 years. Every year, every other year, there's a new kid that they compare to LeBron coming out. He's next on the list is Ben Simmons, but he couldn't even get his team to the tournament. So, yeah, that means that, you know, you're not even good enough to make your team one of the best, like, 68 teams in the country. Like, that's pretty telling, I feel like. Even though he stuffed the stat sheet, that's worrisome. Another point I want to make, and this doesn't, I'm not, this is not an, what I'm about to say is not a criticism of you, Mark. This is an indictment on all draft experts and people that break down the draft for a living, all of them. This is what I kind of bothers me. Whenever you're looking at NBA prospects in the draft, every, like 90% of the players in the draft have the same three deficiencies. They either can't shoot, they can't defend, and they need to bulk up. That, like 90% of the guys in every draft, every NBA draft, have at least two of those deficiencies, if not three. So Brandon Ingram needs to bulk up. Ben Simmons needs to get a better jump shot. Both of those things will come with time. And it's almost like if I was a talent evaluator, I wouldn't even be factoring that in that much. Like, I mean, some guys are just natural born shooters. Like J.J. Redick had an amazing stroke in college, and he can shoot the basketball in the NBA. So you have some guys that can shoot the ball really well at a young age, but by and large, most college players can't shoot that well. They just can't. I mean, if you can find a college kid that can shoot it, then you're going to have somebody that has some real upside, if you will. But, you know, if a guy can't shoot, I don't think that that's even a great knock against him. Same thing if he can't defend or if he's not big enough. So, Ben Simmons' lack of a jumper is concerning. I think, and I understand that's what you're saying that you would do if you were running Philly. I think ultimately they're going to take Simmons and they're going to try to move off of one of those other big men because they need somebody that's supremely talented. And if they feel like he's more supremely talented than Brandon Ingram, they're going to do it. Plus, I think it'd be kind of a PR nightmare if they've been tanking all these years to get the number one pick. They fire the guy that was in charge. They finally get the number one pick with the Colangelos in charge, and then they don't take the consensus top guy. I think you might have a riot on your hands in Philly. But I would surmise then that the Lakers would be doing backflips because Ben Simmons would be on the board at number two. What are the Lakers doing at number two then?
Well, they're taking Ben Simmons, and you know, because that team needs a playmaker. The difference between Philly and the Lakers is the fact that, you know, with the Lakers, they have some pieces already in place, and they're not just a hodgepodge of different guys like Philly has right now. And I think, you know, I agree with you that, you know, that Philly is going to take Ben Simmons, and then in turn that the Lakers will take Brandon Ingram for the purposes of this thing. And I think for what benefits the team overall, it definitely needs to be reversed. Whereas, you know, Ben Simmons is a playmaker, he's a creative guy, and I think with him on the floor, you know, dominating the ball from the small forward standpoint, he'll be able to get Randall shots, help out with the process of D'Angelo Russell, Jordan Clarkson. All these different guys will actually be able to thrive with a guy, a playmaker, showtime, quote-unquote playmaker like Simmons. And I think he fits more in L.A. than he does in Philly, but I agree with you that, you know, consensus is going to tell you that Philadelphia is going to take Simmons and then in turn Brandon Ingram, which is not a bad consolation prize, by the way, for him going to the Lakers. I think either one of them will do well with LA, but I just think from a fit standpoint, I think it would be better the other way around.
And what I think what would be really interesting is seeing D'Angelo Russell play with Ben Simmons, because D'Angelo Russell can pass, but he really likes to shoot. Ben Simmons can also pass and can score, but he doesn't seem to be super aggressive.
Exactly.
I don't know. Their games don't really seem to mesh well together to me, but I would be fascinated to see how it would turn out. Even though I'm not super sold on Ben Simmons, I would say that if he winds up there, that the Lakers would be really excited and would feel like they won the draft. Their arch nemesis, Boston Celtics, picked third. There's been a lot of rumors that they're going to be looking to deal this pick. Would you deal the pick, Mark?
I would deal the pick. One of the things I've heard on the table, and it probably won't happen, but the trade that I would do, I would actually, if I was Boston, I would trade that pick to Philadelphia for Khalil Okafor. And the main reason why I would do that is because on the field, there's a bunch of young guys and no true veteran leadership on that team. Khalil Okafor basically has nobody to keep him in line. So he can't act like a knucklehead. And he can go off and do the things that he's been doing. But from a talent standpoint, if you were to bring Khalil Okafor to Boston, where you already have Isaiah Thomas, where you already have guys like Jay Crowder and Jared Sullinger and all these other guys who Avery Bradley, all these guys who happen to who are established veterans in the NBA, going to a team with a coach like Brad Stevens, I think that would be the best fit for somebody like Okafor, so that he can develop, and then also those other guys, those veterans, can keep him in check. Because he's ultra talented, but I think he's wasting himself in Philly because of the fact that Philly has surrounded him with a bunch of young guys who really, and there's really no structure around him. Although I do like Brent Brown a lot as a coach, I just don't think that he alone can help get a guy like Okafor. And then you go, and it also hurts when you're in a franchise that's just losing. You know what I mean? If you're going to Boston, you're already a playoff team, and you're already in a situation where there's a lot established around you. So if I was Boston, I would trade the pick, and I would definitely try to trade the pick if that was true for Khalil Okafor. However, if they stay where they are, to me, their best bet by staying there is to get somebody who I feel is a sleeper and maybe one of the most intriguing and most explosive players in this draft, and that's Jaylen Brown, a small forward from Cal. Because you can see where they need somebody who can an explosive, athletic wing guy, and they don't have that there. And my thing is, if you get a guy like Jaylen Brown, it also helps out your front court too. Because with all the other picks that Boston has, they can really strengthen up their front court, because I think that was one of their biggest weaknesses. But from a wing player standpoint, Jaylen Brown would be a perfect fit for them.
So Jaylen Brown going to the Celtics and being who I guess James Young isn't, because they drafted James Young out of Kentucky like a couple of years ago, and he had bad Bill Simmons pumping his fist on TV, and like, where has that guy been? I don't even think he's played in like 2 years or whatever.
I have no idea.
So hypothetically, though, real quick, if Philly does make that deal that you're saying, and that means Philly has a number three pick, would you still take Jaylen Brown if you're Philly?
Probably not. If I was them, I would probably use that pick and get myself a point guard, because they have no point guard on that team. And I would, and in my opinion, the best point guard in this draft is Chris Dunn from Providence. That's who I would take. If I was them, I would trade Khalil Okafor. And it's very rare that you trade a big guy for a small guy. But I would trade Khalil Okafor for the opportunity to get Chris Dunn at three. And then that way you put Ben Simmons or Brandon Ingram along with Chris Dunn, and you have an Embiid that's back and healthy. You have Nerlens Noel. Now you got something started there. And then you can bring in a couple of free agent guys to help bolster, lift the age limit on your team, and also, get some more maturity in there, and then start trying to win some ball games.
What about the Phoenix Suns at four? They kind of hit it big with Devin Booker last year at the end of the lottery.
I agree, and I think for them, all of their front court players, if they got rid of all their front court guys, they need help in the front court, especially at the power forward position. So for me, I like the kid Dragan Bender from Croatia, the power forward from there, because he reminds me a lot of Porzingis. The only difference is with between him and Porzingis is that while Porzingis has a nasty jump shot and he's been a big surprise for me from over the course of this season, they rave about Bender's outside shot more than Porzingis' outside shot, and just his ability to to be athletic at that size because he's also 7 feet tall and can spread the floor like that. I think that's, it's now the year of the, it's now the generation of the seven-footers, the athletic seven-footers. And Dirk paved the way for this. Now you see more and more guys who's 7 feet tall that can do all these different things, and especially that's international. These guys, they're going to take over the league at some point. But, yeah, that's the guy I would take if I was Phoenix at four.
You know, what's funny about that, too, is two things. Number one, I love his name, Dragan Bender. That sounds like he's all business.
Yeah, exactly.
And number two is, I think you see in the league all the time, man, whenever like one team does something and it's successful, it works, man, we got to do that. Like, we got to do what they're doing over there. Like, every team does that. And I hate to use the cliche, but I'm willing to anyways. They say it's a copycat league. They say that about the NFL. They say the same thing about the NBA. The Warriors got two guys that can shoot. Now they're saying that they're revolutionizing the basketball in 2016. And, that's overstated. Like, I hear people say that all the time. And it's really more of a reflection on the lack of big men talent that I think is available than that the league is moving into this new direction. And analytics says you got to shoot a bunch of threes and get layups and nothing else. I don't buy into all that entirely. But my point in saying all that is that Dragan Bender seems like the type of dude that's going to go high in the draft based on the success of Porzingis and like guys like Mirotić in Chicago and stuff like that. Like, depending based on the success that those large, those bigger Europeans have had lately that can shoot, I can definitely see a scenario in which his draft stock's going to go flying up. Minnesota has the fifth pick. And they're everybody's favorite young team, man. They're like Oklahoma City in 2009. That's what Minnesota is right now with the last two rookies of the year. And plus, I think they also jettisoned Anthony Bennett. So that instantly made him a better basketball team.
Oh, man.
So, and they got Thibs in the building. Is it Thibs or Tibbs? I don't know if it's Thibs, but whatever his name is, he's the coach now. So everything looks looking good, and there's all these rumors that they're going to trade for my man Jimmy Butler. So shout out to Froggy Fresh with the Jimmy Butler is your father song. I don't know if you ever heard that, Mark, but anyway, Minnesota at five. What's their move?
Well, their best move, and I heard the rumors about Jimmy Butler. Jimmy Butler's not going anywhere, and especially because the Bulls flat out came out and said, okay, we'll give you Jimmy Butler, but in the deal, you got to give us Andrew Wiggins. Like, come on, man. Like,
yeah, that's not happening.
That's not happening. So that just proved that. For me, I'm looking at their roster, and like you said, they're a promising, young, talented roster. And you're right. They remind you of Oklahoma City when they first started out. The biggest, weakest link for me is Ricky Rubio at point guard. Yes, he's a true point guard. Yes, he can pass a rock, but there's two things he can't do. He's still, in this day and age, he's still not a good shooter. He doesn't spread the floor. And number two, defensively, he gets abused. Those two things, for me, that's not going to fly well with Tom Thibodeau. It's just not going to happen. And that's where you have an opportunity, if you're Minnesota, to get the best point guard in this draft. So if, in fact, Boston does not trade their pick, like I was saying, so they can get Okafor and all the other things happen. Chris Dunn is the perfect fit for Minnesota because not only is he a guy that can score points, but he also is there, and he's a guy that Thibodeau is going to love. And I think we put him with a defensive mindset that, you got Zach LaVine now playing your two, you got Wiggins playing your three, you got the Big Cat, you got Pekovic, you got a whole stable of young, talented individuals on that team, you can make that next jump because, as the Western Conference starts these stars start getting older, then the decline starts. So these younger teams have an opportunity now to get into upper echelon, and that's just the nature of the beast and the natural maturity that goes in the NBA. You get Chris Dunn, I think that's the piece where you can actually start building on wins after that.
It almost seems unfair that they would get Chris Dunn. Like, at this point, like, they hit it big with the last two rookies of the year.
Right.
Cat Daddy is that deal. Like,
he is the deal.
He is real deal Holyfield. It seems unfair that they would get Wiggins, Carl Anthony Towns, and Chris Dunn in three straight drafts, especially with this one being the fifth pick, and he just kind of falls in their lap. Is he more of a combo guard? And if he is, does that worry you at all, like that he would be taking shots away from Wiggins and Towns?
He can be looked at as more of a combo guard, but I think he's his decision making, he has to improve on that a little bit. I mean, I think that comes with guys who are premier point guards or guys who score a lot in college. That transition you saw with Kyrie Irving, just having to be able to transition their game where they have to be a floor general, I think it can be a little bit tricky at times. But he has the athleticism. I think he has as much athleticism as John Wall and Gary Payton back in the day, where you can build on him. With him being that athletic, you can build on him defensively. Defensively is where he's going to stand out. And I think, you know, it's just like any other college guard, combo guard. If you're a scorer, if you're primarily a scoring guard, it's going to take you time to start learning how to be a distributor, how to read the defenses, how to read the floor. So it's going to be a transition with Chris Dunn. And maybe during that process and during that time, I mean, even though you still got, you know, all these other, you know, these younger guys on their roster, you still, I mean, Ricky Rubio can still, you know, at least hold that fort for at least half a season, and then maybe you can deal him at the trade deadline. But for me right now, I mean, Chris Dunn's talent supersedes Ricky Rubio, right? I mean, I think he's a better player right now than Ricky Rubio is. The only difference is that Ricky Rubio is a better floor general than he is.
Ricky Rubio is also the last tie, I believe, to David Kahn, the man who selected three point guards in the first round of the NBA draft in 1 year, and none of them were Steph Curry, and he had a shot at Steph.
He had the infamous Johnny Flynn. You can't pass up on Johnny Flynn.
Yeah, he took. Moving right along. New Orleans is number six. Disappointing season for them in Alvin Gentry's first year. Anthony Davis can't seem to stay on the court, but when he's on the court, he's still one of the 10 best players in the league and had like a 59-point, 20-rebound game like a couple of months ago. So what's their move there if you're running the team that plays in Smoothie King Arena?
They need scoring, man. That's their biggest problem. It's Anthony Davis and nobody else. And that's the biggest problem with them. And to me, even though it's in college, you really can't project how that's going to be in the pros. Best scorer in this draft by far is Buddy Hield. And for me, if I'm New Orleans and I need somebody who can put the ball in the hoop, that's where I start. I mean, you got, you know, Drew Holiday and Tyreke Evans, all these other guys, but and they're injury prone and things like that. But you need a guy who can just flat out put the ball in the basket, man. And Buddy Hield is the guy for me at six. And just mainly because if he's anything like he is in college, he's going to take a ton of pressure off of Anthony Davis, and then you'll start seeing that team actually start to build something there.
I love Buddy, man. He's by far my favorite player in this draft. When you look at him, he had that one-on-one NBA game. You know, people like to diss ISO ball all the time. Well, ISO ball kind of just won a championship yesterday.
Right.
And so it's not always all bad, but Buddy has that mentality that he's not going to be bested by the guy in front of him. He's not afraid to go right at him. He's not afraid to take the big shots and make them. And he is a scoring machine, and he's a senior. So I think we may have learned a little bit recently with like the success of people like Draymond Green that drafting a senior is not always a bad thing. Typically, those seniors fall. You know, the best seniors typically go late in the lottery, and then you might see some pop up late in the first round, early second. What you notice, though, from the seniors when they get drafted, there is a certain floor for them. And the reason why everybody takes the guys that they take that aren't seniors, the reason why they always go with freshmen and sophomores is because they want the upside. Well, the seniors, on the other end, they have a high floor. They don't always have a high ceiling, but they usually have a very high floor, which means you're not going to get a bust when you take a senior. And I don't think any team that takes Buddy Hield is going to be upset. Denver is at seven. What's up with the Rich and Creamy Nougats?
Well, I'm looking at their roster, and I think you know, I like Gary Harris. I like a lot of the little, some of the players that they have. Like there's some of their front court guys like Jokic and so on and so forth. But I think they still need help at the power forward position. I think Kenneth Faried is nearing the end, you know, as far as being a viable NBA player. And I think that a power forward that can a young power forward can help them. Although he should have stayed in school, in my opinion, I think Marquise Chris from the power forward from Washington is a good find because you still have, like I said, you still have Faried there. You don't have to rush him in, but I think as he develops, because he has a lot of talent, he's just raw and he's young. And I think and he may like have a couple stints in the D League, like in his first year. But I think from a talent standpoint, I just think he just needs maturity and just being able to get up to the speed of the NBA game. And as long as he's playing and learning, that's where the D League comes in. I think he's going to be the eventual successor for Kenneth Faried. So that's who I would take if I'm Denver at 7.
The bigger issue with Faried to me, I think, and I could straight up be wrong about this. And you know what, y'all, I'm too lazy to go ahead and fact check it right now. I'm just going to toss that out there. But I don't know if Faried got a new long term extension or not. But to me, he just seems like a guy who's a solid player. But I feel like his time in Denver might be short. He's either going to get moved and packaged for something else, or if his contract is up, they're not going to want to pay him the money that he's probably going to want. So they're always the Sacramento Kings have picked 8th. For the 9th year in a row. It's unbelievable.
That's ridiculous. I mean, that team is so snake-bitten. And they're going to be in purgatory. It just seems like they're going to be in purgatory forever. They're just never going to get out of their rut. But, you know, the Rajon Rondo, while he's had some success, he's now a free agent. They're going to let him go. They're going to need a point guard. And it goes back now to my theory about scoring point guards or scoring guards. You have a hard time figuring out whether that guy can actually translate to being a point guard. But if I'm them, I'm looking at Jamal Murray, the point guard/shooting guard from Kentucky. He played point guard in high school. So he's naturally made to be a point guard. His problem is, once again, he scores so much that they look at him as a shooting guard. But he has to understand. People are going to have to understand, there's very few Chris Pauls that's going to be coming out in any draft. Very few guys like Rajon Rondo who's going to be coming out in any draft, who's just pure, or Ricky Rubio's, who are just pure point guards, who are floor generals who are there to set the other teammates up as opposed to scoring. The league is now going to scoring point guards. So for me, if I'm Sacramento, they need somebody who's going to take over the point guard responsibilities. And Jamal Murray, since he was naturally a point guard in high school, he just has to learn how to manage the floor game at the NBA level and still learn how to get his shots off. But I think that's a perfect fit for Sacramento going forward.
Jamal Murray, he feels like another sleeper like Devin Booker last year coming out of Kentucky. He feels like he could be another dude that, you know, he's not in the top five necessarily, but people don't sleep on him because he's going to turn out to be a solid player. And Cal doesn't produce a lot of scrubs coming out of that program, although I think there might be one in this draft. Man, the Kings, man, I think they got to move off DeMarcus Cousins, man. I just don't think it's going to work there. Like, the objective is winning an NBA championship. When are the Kings going to win an NBA championship with DeMarcus Cousins on their roster? Like, I just don't see that happening.
They won't.
If Boogie hasn't gotten them to the playoffs yet in the West, at this point, like, I don't see that it's ever going to happen. And considering all of the headache that he brings to the table, I just don't know what his trade value is. That's the hard part. Like, where do you trade him to, and what are you going to get back for a guy as talented as him with the baggage that he has? It's a tough spot for Vlade Divac to be in, but I think that's ultimately what they're going to have to do. Toronto picks 9th. They were just in the conference finals, and the Cavs gifted them 2 games. But they could use some more help, right? What would you do with them if you were Masai Ujiri? I always mispronounce his name.
One quick thing, just to answer your question about Kenneth Faried, he still has 3 more years on his contract. He did sign an extension. For me, what did they get exposed to? Their backcourt was the guys who scored all their points. Their frontcourt, especially when Valanciunas went out, they didn't provide anything. You have Bismack Biyombo, who had a huge rebounding game, and he gets a lot of garbage points. But Patterson and all these other guys who are in the front court provided absolutely nothing. This is going to be a little bit of a sleeper for me. This is a guy I really, really, really like. You may know by his last name, but Domantas Sabonis is the guy that I would take if I was Toronto, because this kid is ultra talented. I mean, people think of him, you know, try to compare him to his dad. His dad was one of the best passing big men I have ever seen.
Thanks.
And when he was in Portland, he was on his last legs. It's just a shame that he wasn't able to be there his entire career to see how great he was. But his son, man, if you ever watch Gonzaga play, his son is an outstanding basketball player. He's 6'10". He can light it up from the outside. And most importantly, you know, you can get him in a post a little bit. He can make some moves in a post like his dad used to. He would be an outstanding fit as a stretch four for Toronto. And that's a guy that they need scoring up front. That's what killed them.
Yeah, that killed them. Also, the fact that Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan would show up for only half the games. The fact that they had to play LeBron James and Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love also hurt them. But aside from all that, they're in great shape. The Milwaukee Bucks picked 10th. What's their move?
Their move is that they need scoring as well. They have a long, athletic, defensive team, but they don't score enough points. That's the problem with them. And for me, I mean, you have Michael Carter Williams who can't shoot. You got three of your guys. You got Jared Bayless, you got OJ Mayo, and you got somebody else, I believe. I can't remember who, but they're all free agents. So you're going to need scoring. Front court, I mean, you got Giannis, and you got all these other guys that, you know, don't score a ton of points, but you need somebody who can fill it up. And at the 6'6 size, the guy for me in Milwaukee, if Malachi Richardson is there, you better snap this kid up in a hurry, because he will be the absolute perfect fit for them with Jay Kidd, because now you're getting Michael Carter-Williams driving to the hoop. You kick it out to Richardson, who will just light him up from three. And you already have Middleton out there. Middleton's not a starter. So you need somebody who is a difference maker at, you know, from a scoring standpoint. And I think if you put him out there, you have Giannis at your three, and then you have all the other pieces and parts. I think he's a key that can give you a boost on the offensive side.
You know what, man? If I'm Milwaukee, I think I just say screw it, and I just throw caution to the wind, and I think I just make Giannis my full-time point guard and make Michael Carter-Williams expendable and go get trade him for a shooter and put that shooter out there with Jabari, with Malachi, and roll with Giannis, and just make other teams try to deal with a 6'8 dude. He might be closer to 7 feet, but he's got a 9 foot wingspan is the point. His knuckles actually hit the dirt when he walks.
Right.
So make other teams have to deal with their point guard with that situation, and you know, and then go from there. That's kind of maybe how I would handle it. Just because it's something different and teams wouldn't know how to prepare for it. I'm gonna ask for two at a time. In the interest of time, Orlando at 11, Utah at 12.
If I'm Orlando, I'm taking Scal Labissiere, the power forward from Kentucky, because even though he's once again a 7-footer, he's slim, but he has physical tools that I think that could translate into the league. It's gonna take time with him because of the fact that he is just so underdeveloped. And then if I'm Utah at 12, personally, I would trade the pick. Because there's really nobody that's glaring that they can actually use. However, they do have some people that's going to be coming up contract-wise, especially in the front court soon. So from a power forward standpoint, for example, Henry Ellenson from Marquette is an intriguing person I would take if I was Utah. But personally, I would trade the pick first if I was them.
So you said Henry Ellenson for Utah?
Yes.
Scal, man. I don't know, man. I think he's a scrub. That's kind of who I was.
my son hates him too. He thinks he's a scrub too.
I was hinting at him earlier when I was talking about another Kentucky guy might not pan out. Scal just seems like, you know, he got terrible advice to even come out this year. He got a lot of hype last year and then did not have a good freshman year, and it looks like a disaster.
I mean, if you're Orlando, you're not winning anytime soon. So I mean, you could do worse. I'll say what they, who they could possibly take after 13 and 14, because I think one of the guys in 13 and 14 could be a pick for Orlando at 11, but and for the sake of time, I'll wait until that happens. But, yeah, I'm not a huge fan of Scal, but I think his skill set fits what they're trying to do down there.
All right, and that makes sense. And that's all that we're asking for from the mock draft. We just want to know who fits where. Who fits again at Phoenix? Phoenix is back at 13, and then we got the Chicago Bulls kind of surprising people, wound up in the lottery at 14 to round that out. So who you got 13 and 14 as we wrap up the podcast?
Okay, so Phoenix at 13. Phoenix at 13. I'm looking at, I think this offseason, Eric Bledsoe is going to be bye-bye from Phoenix. So they're going to need somebody who can play that combo guard spot. DeJounte Murray from Washington, although, once again, he's a younger guy. It's going to take him a little bit of time to adjust to the NBA game. But I like his skill set for Phoenix and their up-and-down type of style. So I think he's the pick at 13. 14, and this is the person that, you know, Orlando could slip up and take. But I like, if he stays where he is, Chicago taking Deonta Davis, the power forward from Michigan State, because I think he fits the type of rugged type of thing that power forward, aggressive play that, you know, that both Orlando and Chicago can use. So if he stays with Chicago, if he stays there, or he's still on the board when Chicago picks, that's who Chicago's going to take.
Jumping back to Orlando really quick, I know they got Aaron Gordon there, so he's already kind of a project power forward. So I don't know if they can afford to take another one, whether it's Scal or whether it's Deonta Davis. So I'd be a little surprised if they went that route. Let's go ahead and recap the 2016 NBA mock draft with Philly with the top pick. Mark said he would take Brandon Ingram if he was Philadelphia. The Lakers would take Ben Simmons at the number 2 spot. Boston takes Jaylen Brown 3rd. Phoenix takes Dragan Bender 4. Minnesota takes Chris Dunn at 5. New Orleans takes Buddy Hield at 6. Denver takes Marquise Chris at 7. Sacramento takes Jamal Murray at number 8. Toronto takes son of Arvydas Sabonis at number 9. Milwaukee takes Malachi Richardson. And Orlando at number 11 would take Scal Labissiere. I never know how to say his name anyway. Let's call him Scal. Scal goes to Orlando. Utah, number 12, would then take Henry Ellison. Phoenix, if Utah doesn't trade the pick, Phoenix is on the clock again, and they could take DeJounte Murray. And 14, Deonta Davis to the Chicago Bulls, who I think the Bulls are actually, I think they draft better than any other team in the league. I don't think they get enough credit for how well they draft and develop players.
I agree.
Any other final notes about the draft really quick before we go? Do you think the Cavs are going to try to trade back in and get a pick? That's what I heard today.
I would love for them to do that, because they need to start looking at, I mean, you think about it, with RJ now, you know, retiring, at least he says he's retiring.
That's a hole.
Yeah, that's a hole. You got to get a guy. I would love for them to get back in this draft and take a wing guy, you know, or, you know, somebody like that that can help them. Chick Diablo, I mean, my son, he's still, like, questioning why he didn't get much playing time in Kansas. But he's a guy, you know, that would be a nice fit, because even though he's slim and he can take time to develop, but he has a monster upside defensively that you just can't. And he'll be able to guard, you know, a lot of, you know, smaller players and things like that. And he blocks shots, rebounds. He does all the little things that I think that, you know, you really can't teach. You either have it or you don't. And his motor is unparalleled. I mean, that's the type of thing that attracts me to him. But there's other guys in here that, you know, that the Cavs can actually use from a young player standpoint. So, I mean, the opportunity is there, because I don't see Boston using, they have 8 picks. I don't see them using all 8 picks. I don't see Philadelphia using all 6 of their picks. You know, there's going to be some opportunities for the Cavs to get back into this draft. They really want to get into this draft and take a young guy.
The NBA draft is in 3 days, 1 minute and 35 seconds from the time that I'm speaking these words right now, according to NBADraft.net's running clock
that they always have going.
I know you've seen that clock before, Mark.
Oh, yeah.
And speaking of clocks, the time is up on this episode of the podcast. But thank you all for joining the preseason podcast of the year. Shout out to my man, Mark Hicks, my cousin. He is a champion. And so is Vince Hicks. He's a champion. So is Michael Hicks and Kenneth Hicks and Kenneth Hicks Sr. and Kyan Hicks. They're all champions.
Okay. Champion, and
all,
baby.
And all your children, too many to name, they're all champions too.
So
shout out to the city of Cleveland, Ohio. Twitter.com/HHS Report is the Twitter handle. Facebook.com/HHS Report. We're there as well. We are everywhere, man. We're global. We're worldwide out here. But thank y'all for joining us. And congratulations to the Cleveland Cavaliers and the city of Cleveland. Y'all earned it.
All in 216, baby. That's what I'm talking about.
216. Peace.